Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 16th of August, these are our main stories. As Chinese military reinforcements gather at the Hong Kong border, the territory's richest businessman has called for calm on all sides. Police have fired tear gas to disperse supporters of Zimbabwe's main opposition party in the capital, Harare. And Israel says Rashida Tlaib, one of two US congresswomen who were barred from entering the country, will now be allowed to visit her Palestinian grandmother in the occupied West Bank. Also in this podcast, Greenland says it's not for sale following reports that Donald Trump has raised the idea of the US buying the territory, and...
Oh, wait, no, that's not it.
Bird calling, the art of mimicking birds, making a comeback in Australia. For 10 weeks, Hong Kong has seen mass political unrest, and more protests are expected this weekend. What began in June in response to a proposed extradition bill has evolved into a pro-democracy movement. The international airport was occupied, causing major disruption, and violence erupted. Now there are reports that Chinese reinforcements are gathering on the border, ready to intervene. But the commander of Kowloon Police, Yong Man Poon, says local authorities are determined to bring the situation fully under control themselves.
I can tell you, we are confident that we have the capability to maintain law and order in Hong Kong. In general, from my personal contact with my frontline troops, they are motivated, we still maintain very high morale, and we love our place, and we want to contribute.
There have been various calls for calm, the latest from the territory's richest businessman, Lee Ka-shing, who has taken out a series of full-page newspaper adverts, as our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, explained.
Well, Lee Ka-shing essentially symbolises the spirit of business in Hong Kong. He's been around a very long time. He's in his 90s now, worth about $30 billion US dollars. Born in China, and many of his businesses are over the border in China. So when he speaks, people tend to listen. He's essentially called for calm. Not really said whether he supports the protesters or the authorities, but asking people just to calm down somewhat. And his calls follow a number of similar statements from businesses in the territory over the last couple of days. They're worried that all these protests are going to undermine business, which, and we found out just today that the economy in Hong Kong shrank by 0.4% in the last quarter. All this comes ahead of a weekend when more protests are planned, speculation that China might intervene. So really, tension's still very high in Hong Kong.
And meanwhile, the CEO of the airline Cathay Pacific has resigned following pressure from Beijing. How does that relate to the protests?
This relates to the protests because Cathay Pacific, the company which he headed, has been embroiled in the protest. A couple of weeks ago, the Chinese authorities said that no plane from Cathay Pacific could fly to China if they had a staff member on board who'd taken part in the protest or supported the protest. Initially, the airline refused to comply. Then it did a U-turn. It sacked two pilots, said it supports the Chinese government and is against unlawful protests. But really, it's been caught in the middle of these protests. And it's an example of really of how the Chinese authorities can put pressure on businesses in Hong Kong to comply with its will and try to squeeze the protesters in that way as well.
That was Michael Bristow. Planned opposition protests against the Zimbabwean government have been abandoned, but that didn't stop some defiant citizens of Harare taking to the streets. The police banned the planned official demonstration by the Movement for Democratic Change. That ban was upheld in court, and a spokesman for the MDC said they would postpone the protests. Daniel Molokelo from the MDC said their campaign would continue regardless.
Effectively, the junta has decided to suppress Section 59 of the Constitution using the police, using state resources, using state security forces. So we are not able to proceed with the march today. We are not backing down. we are going forward. The people of Zimbabwe are tired, they are fed up, they want to end this long suffering.
Our correspondent Shingai Nyoka, who's in Harare, said the police had taken action against those not deterred from protesting.
They had earlier, several hours ago, dispersed protesters, several hundreds of them. But in the last few minutes, some of them, about a dozen or so, have come back to the same spot, chanting in defiance of this court ruling and the police ban. The police are still, they still have a heavy presence here, and they keep dispersing these protesters.
And tell us a little bit more about the economic environment that the opposition wanted to protest against in the first place.
Well, it's very clear to everybody here that the economic situation has worsened over the last year or so. What we've seen are power outages up to 18 hours a day, water shortages because of a drought, but also high inflation. Prices have increased and salaries haven't been able to keep up. And that's essentially what people are protesting. They're saying that their standard of living has declined. Medical doctors, for example, earn about $100 US a month. Some of the people that we spoke to said that they're qualified plumbers, electricians, but they're sitting at home. And that's really what's caused many of the people that we see here today to come out, express their frustration. They want the situation to be turned around, and they don't believe that President Emmerson Mnangagwa can do that for them.
And there has been, hasn't there, a reported crackdown on dissent in the country in recent weeks.
Well, what we've heard from the Human Rights Forum is that over the last few days, at least half a dozen civil society members and opposition members were allegedly abducted and tortured. They believe that it's with state agents. One of the reasons that one of the abductees gave was that he was told that he was mobilizing protesters, but the government has denied that. They said Emmerson Mnangagwa would not do that, and that he upholds the principles of democracy, and that those perpetrators will be investigated and arrested if they are found.
That was Shingai Nyoka in Harare. Before Donald Trump was the US president, he was a real estate mogul, and it seems he has not left his old career behind him. According to the Wall Street Journal, he's asked White House officials to investigate whether the United States can make a particularly extravagant purchase, Greenland. Officials in Greenland have responded by saying that it's not for sale. Charlotte Gallagher has been following the story.
The national anthem of Greenland, a self-governing region of Denmark located just to the northeast of Canada. It's famous for its stunning scenery and wildlife, but it's in the news for a very different reason. President Trump has apparently set his sights on adding it to his real estate empire. He's reportedly curious about the island's natural resources, like oil, coal and uranium. He's also interested in its location. The White House has already identified the Arctic as an area of growing importance to national security. America already has a military base there with hundreds of personnel. Administration officials aren't sure how serious President Trump is, but perhaps surprisingly, it wouldn't be the first time the US has tried to buy Greenland off Denmark. President Harry Truman offered $100 million in 1946. It's also not the first time Donald Trump has eyed business opportunities while in the White House. He told North Korean leaders they could build holiday resorts and hotels there, despite the fact many people are afraid to visit. The idea of him adding Greenland to his real estate empire hasn't gone down well in either Denmark or Greenland. The former Danish Prime Minister, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, said it had to be an April Fool's joke, totally out of season. While the right-wing Danish People's Party was even more blunt, saying if Donald Trump is truly contemplating this, it's the final proof that he's gone mad.
That was Charlotte Gallagher. Liam Malone, a 25-year-old from New Zealand, has proven himself against the best in the world, winning two gold medals in sprint events at the 2016 Paralympics in Rio. Liam took just 3 years to become the best, but now he's set himself a new goal. After announcing his retirement from blade running, he's trying his hand at something new, his first stand-up show at the largest arts festival in the world, the Edinburgh Fringe in Scotland. Kate Gregan went to watch him.
You want to go to a free comedy show? Oh, staring at the leagues without taking a flyer. Amazing, yep.
It was a steep learning curve for Liam Malone, cajoling people into a show they may not have chosen otherwise. He wasn't going to give up.
Here I am outside Liam's venue in the heart of Edinburgh. We've got about 40 people outside who have all been promised 1 hour of dark comedy. Let's remember that he's competed at the Paralympics with millions of people around the world watching. But this is something entirely different, a small, intimate crowd keen to see if he's just as good at comedy as he is running.
I'm just nervous, horrendously nervous. I shouldn't be here, I'm underprepared. When I was running at the Rio Paralympic Games, I was running for my country. But comedy's like something that I've always wanted to do. So like while it was like obviously so important to go out and perform for New Zealand, this is even more pressure because it's something that I want to be good at. How are we doing? Hello, hello, hello.
Hello.
You good?
Yeah.
It's really good to be here. How is everyone feeling? Particularly the able-bodied people at the back. They feel really good about themselves. I grew up with a disability, right?
Liam's philosophy is that his lack of legs is key to his success in both sport and life in general. He's not one to shy away from his disability. In fact, his comedy wouldn't be the same without it.
Oh, that was a weird thing that happened after the Paralympics. I received thousands of messages from people with amputee fetishes. And they all wanted the same thing, a photo of my stumps. We'll pay you $50 for a photo of your stump. So I wrote back, I am a Paralympic double gold medalist. I'm at least worth 100.
I feel lucky to have no legs, because if I didn't have no legs, I would be the most boring, basic dude from Nelson. I'd have nothing different about me. I'd probably be a builder. That's why I say I don't see it as a disability.
I think it's important for us to see society at large reflected.
Mary Taylor is the executive producer of Birds of Paradise Theatre Company, a theatre creating work with and for disabled people in Scotland. She welcomes Liam's show.
We are very aware of the impact of the disabled person being seen on stage. Not only have the stories of disabled people and their experiences on stage, but that they see that that is being told by disabled people and represented by disabled people.
That is the show. Thank you guys very much.
Yeah! What did you think of Liam's show tonight?
I thought it was really good. He knows how to approach an audience and he knows what to get him on side.
It doesn't matter if you've got a disability, you're still that person. That's the way I see it. And I think for him to do what he did, you know, there, and to, like, took guts to do that in front of everybody and get up. It's not easy to get up, and what he's gone through, good on him.
That was so hard.
But did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I loved it. I had the best time ever. And I'll keep going. I would describe it as like the moment when I raced my first ever race and I got to the end, and that was my only goal, to get to the end. And from here on out, just stay consistent.
Athlete and comedian Liam Malone, and he was talking to Kate Gregan. Now, here's Jill McGivering to tell us what's on The World This Week.
This week, we're all about bitter struggles for and against change. Long-running protests in Hong Kong turn violent and cause chaos. How far will Beijing go to stop them? India defends its radical change to Kashmir's status and continues to stifle protest there. The British government's struggle to leave the EU gets even more ugly. And the world's best-known eco-warrior set sail to challenge the way we travel. What would it take to stop you boarding a plane?
That's all in The World This Week. Still to come on this podcast, the 9-year-old girl suing a male voice choir, saying it's discrimination that she can't join. North Korea says it'll never sit down for talks with South Korea again. In an excoriating statement, it described as shameless the South Korean leader Moon Jae-in, who gave a speech on Thursday in which he vowed to unite the Korean Peninsula by 2045. And it questioned whether his thought process was sound. Laura Bicker is in Seoul.
Blistering attack on President Moon just 24 hours after he had made this soaring address talking about reunification by 2045, a peace economy with North Korea. And today, certainly, President Moon will have woken up to see this statement, which initially came out in Korean, very colourful language. We've got to remember this is the kind of state media that came up with the word dotard to describe Donald Trump. They described President Moon as shameless. They described him as delusional for thinking that dialogue would take place soon. And they said that his remarks on reunifying the Korean Peninsula were so preposterous that they would make the boiled head of a cow laugh.
So that's all pretty unequivocal, isn't it? Does this mean that Pyongyang is now deciding that it's better off ignoring Seoul altogether and just talking direct to Washington?
It may well be. In the statement, it is pretty straightforward that they do not want to sit down with South Korea again, that they would have nothing to talk about. But it is worth pointing out that this statement is not from a name. It's not from a named committee in terms of one that we would usually recognise as an official source from Kim Jong-un's leadership. And it's not been named. So there is a kind of almost a dangling of hope there for President Moon. But it does seem that Pyongyang is hedging its bets on Washington rather than Seoul right now. And, you know, if you look at the last few weeks, you can perhaps see why. It has continually tested short-range ballistic missiles. And Donald Trump has brushed it off. He said it doesn't matter. These are only short-range missiles. Well, when it comes to these short-range missiles, they are proving to be new missile systems, and they're capable of flying very low, very fast. And analysts believe that some of them at least would be capable of avoiding being shot down by the detection systems here in South Korea. So they are a threat to a US ally. But you wouldn't know that from the words coming from Donald Trump's mouth. So maybe they've decided that, look, when it comes to Washington, they will not recognise South Korea's place. They're also putting pressure on Seoul for various reasons. So maybe we need to deal directly with Donald Trump. Maybe we need to deal directly with Washington and leave Seoul out.
And in the meantime, there have been two more missile tests, haven't there?
Yes, just at the same time as a statement was issued, two more missile tests. They appear to be at this stage short-range ballistic missile tests, again flouting 11 UN sanctions and again showing that despite the fact they're under very strict, very stringent international sanctions, they are capable of building new weapon systems. This one was launched from the East Coast, flew around 230 kilometres, about 120 miles, and landed in the Sea of Japan. It may well be just one more missile test to make a point, or it may well be that Kim Jong-un has all of these weapons, had them all ready to test at a time that was convenient to him.
That was Laura Bicker in Seoul. In our earlier podcast, we covered the case of the US Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, banned from entering Israel following pressure from President Trump. The decision triggered widespread criticism, and now, in a fresh development, Israel has granted permission to the Democratic representative Rashida Tlaib to visit her elderly grandmother in the occupied West Bank. More from our Jerusalem correspondent, Yoland Nell.
Basically, after being told that Israel wouldn't allow her to make the visit that she'd planned to East Jerusalem and the West Bank with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib sent a short letter to Israel's interior minister asking to be allowed just to visit her relatives who live in a little village on the edge of the West Bank. She said it could be her last opportunity to see her grandmother, who's in her 90s. And this request has been granted. She said in her letter that she'd stick with any restrictions and she wouldn't promote boycotts against Israel during her trip.
Right. So if she sticks to that, then that means that this is a completely different kind of visit.
That's correct, because she was expected to go round meeting Palestinians from different civil society groups, travelling around the West Bank, going to other Palestinian cities, to Bethlehem, to Hebron, for example. Not too many details have been announced, but she was also expected to go to East Jerusalem, to the heart of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, of course, to visit the holy site that Muslims called Haram al-Sharif, where the location of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, known to Jews as Temple Mount. And that was something that the Israelis in particular expressed concerns about. When Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, said that this trip would not be allowed after pressure from President Trump, who tweeted saying that allowing them entry would show great weakness, he did actually leave the door open to a humanitarian grounds trip for Rashida Tlaib because she's of Palestinian descent. Ilhan Omar, of course, was born in Somalia but grew up in the US.
And just briefly then, no change to the status of Ilhan Omar's invitation?
That's correct. This only applies to Rashida Tlaib and is for a very specific reason, allowing her to visit just her relatives.
And Yolande Nell was talking to Dan Damon. Now, let's have a bit of culture. As we record this podcast, a German court is due to rule on whether a prestigious boys' choir must let girls join. The parents of a 9-year-old girl say the Berlin State and Cathedral Choir discriminated against her when it turned her down at audition. Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders, is here in the Global News Pod studio to tell us more. So why is this choir, Mike, opposed to letting little girls join?
A lot of it's to do with tradition, because this choir was founded in 1465 by Frederick II, the Elector of Brandenburg, and it was his kind of gift to Berlin to curry favour with them when he wanted to build a castle there. So he brought 5 boys in to start this choir, and it's been boys only for the remaining period. There are now 300 or so people in the choir. 250 of them are boy choristers, and the rest are young men up to the age of 25. And why should they break that line is one of the arguments.
So this little girl says that this is discrimination, though, or her family does anyway.
It does. Partly it's because this choir had received state funding. So she argues that you cannot take taxpayers' money if you're having a qualification that only boys can join this choir. Now, she is already a member of a choir, of a couple of choirs, the Berlin Comic Opera Children's Choir and also the Frankfurt Cathedral School Choir. So you would have thought that she's got the perfect qualifications for it. But she did have an audition and they turned her down, the Berlin choir, because they said that her voice didn't really quite fit with a boys' choir. And they also said that they weren't sure that they could work with the family, which perhaps has been borne out by this court case.
So it's definitely not that she can't sing.
Oh, she can sing all right. She can sing all right. But it's whether or she can sing in the right tone, the tone they're looking for as a boys' choir. Now, I actually made a mixtape, nerd that I am, and I tried it out on a few people in the office. Let's try it out on the listeners now. So here we go. Here's the tape. Right, that's version one. Let's have a listen to how it goes on.
Both very tuneful and very lovely. I'm not sure I can really detect the difference in tone, though.
Well, people with a keen ear would say, oh, it's the boy is the second one. The boy, in fact, is the second one. And they're not the Berlin choir. There are other choirs. It's Allegri Miserere, which probably listeners would recognise. But
Very erudite, our listeners.
I think they are, yes. So that's the argument. The choir says, well, there is a substantive difference and her voice doesn't fit.
And there is a lot of attachment to lengthy tradition everywhere, not just in Germany, here as well. What sort of reaction has there been to this case?
Well, the British soprano Leslie Garrett has been quite dismissive of the idea of boys-only choirs in the 21st century. She says it's a throwback to a bygone age and you really cannot tell the difference between a boy's voice and a girl's voice. And I think we kind of illustrated that a bit here. And she wants the King's College Choir in Cambridge, which does all the Christmas carols, to admit girls for the first time.
Thank you for that, Mike. That was our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders, who I'm told has a very pleasing baritone. The Australian bush is home to hundreds of species of native birds, all of which make a unique sound. Now they are being mimicked by a bunch of young students as part of a revived school competition dating back from the 1950s. The BBC's Freya Cole has this report.
This is the Bonda Bird Olympics. Clarity is key, so is enthusiasm and accuracy.
Don't mind, it's going to be loud.
Okay.
That's the sound of an Australian bellbird. It's one of the entries into a friendly competition which mimics the sounds of native birds.
Oh, wait, no, that's not it.
These students live in the far south coast of New South Wales in the Bega Valley, where the noble art of bird calling is being revived.
What can you do?
A magpie.
Well, let's hear a magpie.
It's a local tradition which dates back to the 1950s and 60s, but it's only recently been brought back to life. These men are former bird calling school champions and now have the important job of mentoring the next generation. That was a familiar cackle of the kookaburra, followed by a fan-tailed cuckoo. The winner automatically becomes a local hero, but no matter the outcome, they're all winners, and the birds think so too.
That was Freya Cole in Australia. Now, before we go, it's time for News from Elsewhere, our weekly look at some of the less reported news stories from around the world. Alistair Coleman from the BBC monitoring team is here. Now, Alistair, in the words of the band Talking Heads, you've got a story about the road to nowhere from Russia, haven't you?
Yes, I have. It's from the city of Yaroslavl, where the authorities have built a brand new road into the centre of the city, but they forgot to finish it. According to one driver who went down it on the first day, it was his kilometre to hell as he was trying to reach Gagarin Street, where the end of the road is supposed to have been. It was instead just mud, potholes, hedges, and a short period going through an industrial estate instead of the finished road itself.
And that, bizarrely, is not the only Russian road-based scandal this week.
No, it is all kicking off in Russia this week with roads. In Novosibirsk, there's a load of road workers. They've actually lost their jobs because they went very old school with their repairs. They decided to dig a hole and then fill it up with straw. This got filmed by passers-by who were wondering what this, and I quote, neo-Tsarist technology was going on. And the local authorities got involved, and three people were dismissed from their jobs, including the foreman, who actually lost his job, not for the repair, but for the fact that he was smoking a cigarette near to the straw.
It's not the first time that there have been road repair issues, is it, in Russia?
Not at all. I mean, I've had problems driving in the UK. I once drove down through Reading and the road just stopped. And I drove around the football ground and came back again. That was a long time ago while they're still building it. But here we are in Russia again, and we're looking at the Urals here now. A couple of years ago, where a village was rather frustrated by the fact that the one road through the centre of where they lived was just basically like the surface of the moon, just cunningly linked potholes filled with water. So these local grannies, babushkas, as you know.
Never doubt a babushka.
Never doubt a redoubtable babushka. They all stumped up 500 rubles each, which at the time was about $8 or £7. And they bought in gravel, they bought in sand, they picked up their tools and they fixed the road themselves.
That's tremendous and top marks for babushka improvisation. Thank you to Alistair Coleman from BBC Monitoring, who has brought us this week's news from elsewhere. And that is it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, or let us hear your bird song impressions, or you have any thoughts on male voice choirs, you know where we are. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.